Our intelligence agency turns 70 this year. ASIO was formed in 1949 after it was revealed sensitive British and Australian government documents were being transmitted from the Soviet embassy in Canberra to Moscow. It began as a counterintelligence agency, but according to a new book, it became more adept at prying into the lives of Australians than catching foreign spies. And over the past seven decades, has become more secretive than its American counterparts. At least that's what the book says. It's called Secret: The Making of Australia's Security State. Its author is Brian Toohey, a veteran Australian journalist, 50 years experience, who's had the pleasure of having his home phone tapped by ASIO twice. Brian Toohey, welcome back to breakfast.
Morning.
Twice? Why did they tap your phones?
Oh, I don't know.
You must have been having some pretty exciting conversations.
Oh, I don't know.
Your book begins with the story of ASIO's founding, and it's quite a curious story, really, but the government felt or believed that their documents were finding their way to Moscow. What happened?
Well, they believed that because of an intercept program by the Americans and deciphering those cables. And they came up with a couple of names in the Foreign Affairs or External Affairs Department then. And there were some documents, a couple of documents, none of them. You can get those documents from the British archives now. They were from Britain, right? And they're so trivial as to be ludicrous. And the notion that they were of any value at all. So that's why I'm a bit surprised that the official history, which ASIO funded to the tune of $1.7 million, says that they would be invaluable for the USSR. Well, the USSR actually was the one they got, the big fish they got, was someone working in this decoding program called Venona, who gave them all of the information about how it worked in 1948. So obviously they changed their codes and all that sort of stuff. Huge espionage activity.
What was the original remit for ASIO?
It was set up basically as a copy of the British one, MI5, counterintelligence. Yeah.
And that evolved over time. And in fact, successive Australian governments, as we talk about today, but you look at from a more historic perspective, have increased ASIO's powers. Mm. That story has sort of run right the way through its history.
Well, the big thing here was that in the beginning, they tapped hardly any phones. What ASIO did was, without the government's, well, you know whether the government knew or not, collected a whole lot of files on Australians about legislative subversion and that sort of stuff. They're all just tittle-tattle. What happened, however, and what really mattered is that they had no executive powers. If they wanted to talk to you, you didn't have to talk to them. And they were not anonymous, whereas the Hawke government took the first bad step on this, was making their names a secret. You couldn't reveal their names, whereas if the police approach you, they've got to say who they are. Next step was then worse than that. The Howard government gave them full executive powers to basically detain and question people in secret for a week. And they were not necessarily even suspected of any crime, but they sure committed a very expensive crime if they didn't answer the questions or told anyone about what they'd been asked.
You spent a portion of your career reporting from the United States. How does secrecy in the American national security establishment compare with the Australian version of it?
Well, I think the New York Times a while back said that we are the most secretive government in the West, and that's true. They've got some protection from the First Amendment protecting free speech, and that's how the Pentagon Papers, the Supreme Court, ruled in favour of the New York Times and published them at the time of the Vietnam War.
Where has that culture come from in Australia, that sort of deep, secretive culture?
I think it comes from very, very weak politicians allowing the intelligence agencies to get their way. And both sides of politics, they just nod these things through without making really enormous changes to Australians, the law, and to Australians' personal liberty, and to the liberty to publish things, without even giving it a flip of notice, basically. But
presumably that's based on briefings and appeals that they get from the security agencies themselves.
There's no reason for the politicians to take any notice of what the intelligence agency says about how they need more power. Menzies, I'll give you an example, he's not regarded as a wild libertarian, but when he was Prime Minister, his Attorney General presented him with a new Espionage Act, and he threw the lot out. The lot. Not a single clause was left in it.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that you see the gradual accrual of power by ASIO as part of Australia's attempts to get closer to the United States. Can you explain that?
Well, I think that's only part of it. By the way, that's other intelligence agencies, not just ASIO, that's involved here in Australia. I don't think it's necessarily so much that they're using the intelligence agencies to get closer to America, although they have an enormous influence. The entire governments of both sides have tried to get closer. As the American policy gets more and more aggressive and more erratic in the world, we try to get closer. There's a Congressional Research Service study which shows that America has used military force in its international relations on 160 occasions since the end of the Cold War. Now, some of those were major wars, some of them were much lesser instances of that. Whereas, you know, our main adversary at the moment never used military force during that period at all. And
Your book was completed before the AFP raids on the home of News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst and on the ABC earlier this year. You will have seen the reports that the Director General of Home Affairs, Mike Pezzullo, called the AFP chief to congratulate him on those raids. Do you see those raids as an escalation of the security state that you describe?
Well, yes. I mean, for many, many years, the government's focused on trying to catch people who leaked things, and they weren't so intent. They tried to prevent the publication using injunctions and so forth, but it was this. In subsequent years, governments, the security establishment has got all these laws through saying not only is it the crime is not only the people who leak it, the whistleblowers or whatever, but also the journalists and anyone basically in the media organisation that publishes it. I just should make very clear here that the whole idea of publishing secrecy is always, always a terrible thing. Never once in Australia has the leak of any intelligence killed anyone. But keeping intelligence secret kills lots of innocent people overseas. For say, example, in drone attacks, some of that information would have come from Pine Gap in the middle of Australia.
The argument that is put by security agencies against leaks into the media and into the public domain is that it compromises security relationships that we have with our security partners.
Oh, rubbish. I mean, America's in no position to really talk about security. The two big leaks has been the WikiLeaks stuff coming out of America and, of course, Snowden's stuff on how the National Security Agency's massive, massive both surveillance and warfighting, because these intelligence agencies, those electronic ones, are engaged in real-time warfighting for the United States. Look, the sensible politicians realise that sometimes leaks are useful to them. President Kennedy was probably the most notable in that regard. He implored the New York Times, back then he was a pretty close-knit thing there, with the New York Times he had, not to publish a report about training by the CIA of mercenaries to go back into Cuba and invade it, right? And the invasion, the New York Times agreed, and the invasion was a complete farce. And later Kennedy told, and this is in a book by one of the executives, told them that he only wished that you'd let them go ahead because then the invasion would not have gone on and saved us from a calamity, was his words.
I suppose a key question that many Australians have and many people listening this morning will wonder. Most organisations, most institutions that are government agencies have oversight from government and therefore technically from the Australian public. Do our security agencies, in your view, have genuine oversight by the Parliament, by therefore the Australian public?
The Parliament is useless as a it's a coalition committee. It just does whatever and agrees to us whatever the intelligence organisations want. What's different is there is a supervisor, inspector general of the intelligence agencies, and she is very good. The trouble is she's got almost no staff, and it's treated with contempt by the government and by the officials. For example, when this really draconian new law came in about forcing tech companies and that to give access, even forcing them to build access into their systems to get into encrypted material, they didn't even bother to show a draft bill to the Inspector General, but they showed it to the so-called Five Eyes partners, with Five Eyes being that sort of Anglo-Saxon club which we share electronic intelligence with the US.
Brian Toohey, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
The book is called Secret, The Making of Australia's Security State. It's out today from Melbourne University Press.